stay on the right side of the road except when passing, and don't cross the yellow line.
Yes, all okay. of that.
So the telephone number, if you'd like to call in here today, presuming that where you are today is Saturday, January 6th, you can call in to 254-773-1400. You can ask us questions. You can tell us what you think about us. You can make comments about anything to do with the economy, investing, or economics. That's pretty much the limit of our knowledge and understanding of the universe. And if you call in and you want to find out about sports teams or anything to do with sports, you probably are going to be disappointed. So again, 254-773-1400 number is the telephone number to call if you'd like to join with us here today on January 6th, our first program of the new year, and somebody is actually calling us. So caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Well, I'm playing host right now to some Vyrai. My wife refers to it as the Christmas plague.
Good question. Good. I was all set to answer that question even before the call. So that
you were?
Yeah, makes it even better. Okay. Thanks for the question. There's a couple of reasons. Venezuela's being one of them. Have you tracked this at all?
Well, Venezuela, as far as I know, has remained pretty consistently on the northern coast of South America, and I'm trying to track it, but it's headed around the world pretty fast right now.
Yes. Well, Venezuela, part of OPEC, is a major producer in OPEC. United Arab Emirates are also major producers in OPEC, but they are not traditionally bound by the things that they agree to at OPEC. Usually they will say, yes, we will cut back on our exports and we will cut back on our production, but then they wind up not. And the reason why we have one of the reasons, there's multiple reasons, of oil prices coming up right now. UAE is coming in as the next president of OPEC. They do this rotating president position. The Saudis are always very good at following OPEC's advice because they basically are OPEC. They say this is what we're going to do, and that's what they do. The UAE occasionally does and occasionally doesn't, but coming in as president, they've said we've got to do it. So they've cut back their production to what they said they were going to cut it back. Venezuela, through no fault of its own, has cut back production. The no fault of its own means that they can't afford to pay the people to work on the oil stuff anymore. So production is falling. They're pretty near social and economic collapse in a major way there. So combine those two factors with the fact that the dollar has been falling on the world stage. The price of the dollar versus the euro or the yen or many of the other currencies is lower. $1 buys fewer of those things. Oil is purchased in dollars on the world stage. Let's put those two together. When someone in Germany buys oil, the price of oil has not gone up appreciably in the last few months. But on the world stage, if we were to be buying oil with dollars, our amount of oil, the price of oil, has gone up because the euro has gotten more expensive to the dollar. Internally, the price is the same with the dollar price going up for oil. And that's what we're seeing, is that the demand in Europe, which is now fully moving out of its recession, is up. Demand in Asia and a lot of the other emerging countries are up. Now let's do the flip side. How long should we expect this? Oil production is ramping up at a pace that has not been seen since fracking started in the United States. So production is going up at a rate that is previously unseen, obviously. What that means is that for a short period of time, the next 3 to 6 months, I would expect to see some more minor upward movements of oil prices, depending on how fast they can get that Texas tea to market. The price should drop. And that is because the United States is sometime in the middle of this month, January of 2018, about to hit the category of the highest producing oil country. It's about to pass up Russia. We just passed up Saudi Arabia at the end of December. We're about to pass up Russia, and it has nothing to do with the traditional oil techniques. It's all fracking. Do you think I hit all the pieces there?
I think way back in October, there were predictions that around this time of the year, you'd see an increase in oil prices. And it is one of the things that's important to recognize is when we see oil prices, what we're actually seeing is oil futures in most cases. So what really boils down to the fact that there are a significant group of investors or significant quantity of investment money that is willing to bet that the price of oil will go up. And that causes the price of oil to go up in the futures contracts. And those contracts are very real in many cases and were delivery received, unlike some other things. So the fact that there is a consensus right now that at least part of that is because of fears over the protests in Iran and the cuts done by OPEC have definitely, the OPEC production, the oil production out of OPEC is down pretty significantly from where it was several years ago, not because of a lack of oil, but because they have agreed to cut their production. So all of this floats together, so we go from $50 a barrel to $60 a barrel. But among the professionals who've been pretty accurate in the past, it ain't going to stay there. We're due for it to trend down.
Yeah, the cost of producing it is much lower than that. Much lower than that. So a good profitability lays in about the $40 to $45 a barrel mark in the United States, and that means that the reason why we're seeing unprecedented production is because they're making a huge amount of money when they get that to market.
And one of the things that's kind of pumped the futures price up is that U.S. commercial crude inventories, in other words, all the oil stored in the United States, is down about 20% from where it was in March. A lot of people think is on increased demand, but we'll see. But the other side of it, and Jake mentioned this, this has caused the fracking drilling to kick into high gear. And we have another caller on 773-1400. So you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, we lost the caller.
That was a very low intelligence caller, guys, based on
beeping,
the comment.
Beeping. The censorship bureau did not like them. They made a caller. Either that or they hung up, which is probably more likely.
Probably the truth. And, you know, there have been some odds and ends happen along the way that it gets blamed on. But the fact is, the price of oil, the forces generating changes in the price of oil are sometimes, to say the least, opaque.
OPEC.
Well, in this case, more opaque. And we have another caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Well,
there are a few places where it's still profitable to do that. It's just not going to be the deep well drilling that was profitable a few years ago.
When oil was at $100 a barrel or more, very big investments on high-risk holes in the bottom of the ocean were quite popular. But the risk of the damage that was done to British Petroleum by one hole in
BP,
the ground.
BP, not British Petroleum. They changed their name.
Yeah, BP. Beep, beep.
Beep.
The damage that was done to them by the Deepwater Horizon accident almost sunk the company. So when you throw a risk factor in at that level, It's just like there has been no rush to bid on the leases that were opened up by the Interior Department in the Anwar National Wildlife Refuge for
a couple of reasons.
One, it's the infrastructure is not there to get it out. It's very expensive.
What that means is
very high risk.
What we just saw in North Dakota, if you recall the pipeline that had all of the protests. Imagine the protests there at the National Preserve.
Well, I think there would be fewer people camping out.
Yeah, but the other piece of it is it costs a lot to take all the equipment up there.
And there is a very large portion of American and European consumers who are relatively sensitive to oil companies doing things to damage the environment. The oil companies are aware of that, and remember that the oil companies is in the business of selling petroleum to people who use it. And ultimately, the people who use it in most cases are people who don't want wildlife refuges being destroyed and don't want a lot of oil dumped into the ocean. On the other hand, the risk from drilling a fracking hole either in the United States or now Russia is opening up a new area where they think they've got a lot of frackable oil, is pretty low. It's they're pretty sure that the oil's down there and they can put a hole in the ground, the oil will be there, and there is a process by which they can extract the oil. So despite the fact that the Trump administration is opening up these areas which were closed previously because of environmental sensitivity, don't expect a commercial company to go rushing in to take a risk on angering a very large portion of the world population and potentially getting sued out of existence for an oil spill.
Now, BP's damage, if you just think about this for a second, we're out in waters that are associated with the United States, but they're a long ways out there. And the damage that they created was kind of one of the things that's kind of a hypothetical damage. It's something that anybody that's been on military maneuvers in Germany, if you run over a chicken, you don't just pay for the chicken in Germany. You pay for the chicken's offspring. How many generations down does that go?
I don't remember.
It's like six or seven generations of chickens that you have to pay for. BP, if you look at the actual damage that happened, there was some damage, and it ran in the tens of millions of dollars. There was a lot of damage done to BP, and that oil that they would have recovered didn't get recovered. There was a lot of money lost there. But when you think about just the beach cleanups, you're talking about tens of millions. Then you throw in the other damages.
These are the economic damages.
The existential damages that are kind of ripple effects that are really hard to measure of two fishing fleets. And how long does that last? How long are you allowed? Because at no point did the Agriculture Department or any other governmental department say it was not safe to fish in the Gulf of Mexico. But people didn't fish in the Gulf of Mexico because the consumers were saying, where did this fish get caught? The consumers were saying, I don't want to eat this oyster if it's full of chemicals. So there are hypothetical and existential damages that have to do with something that we don't know how to value very well. That's a risk that companies don't want to take.
And there was a damage between the two that was probably the largest damage in dollar terms, and that is the loss of business in the tourist industry all along the coast in the area where oil was washing up. It didn't take a lot of oil to wash up.
Right.
It's just people did not want to go to the coast because they heard the bad news, even if there was no damage to that section of the coast.
The news itself was a damage to the coast because tourists didn't show up that would have shown up if there hadn't been a Deepwater Horizon's disaster.
And you could say, okay, they really didn't do that much damage, so what was the big deal? Well, in fact, I can see the value in creating, for lack of better terms, the artificial damage.
Yeah, it's not artificial. It's real. It's real damage.
But by magnifying it out of proportion, you could say, well, that was excessive. And it isn't, because there were times, and I remember, I'm old enough to remember sections, places in the United States where oil spills had made rivers and whole areas smell like crude oil and look like crude oil, and there was nothing alive in those areas because I'm from Oklahoma, and I saw lots of places where there are massive oil spills, and nobody cared or did anything about it. It was very routinely for me, I would go fishing someplace, and there would be an oil slick on the water because somewhere upstream, an oil company had drilled a well and leaked some oil out. And the Clean Water Act passed because of a probably overblown report of the Cahoya River catching on fire. It did catch on fire. It's not the first river to ever catch on fire in the United States. It was put out fairly quickly, but the television media showed pictures, not of that river on fire, by the way, but pictures of the Detroit River, which was a different river altogether, years before, where there had been an oil spill of naphtha into the river, and it had been burned off, and they had lots of TV TV tape of that fire. So they showed that when the report came that the Cahoya River was on fire. In fact, the Cahoya River got put out, but the point is, those rivers were, they were worse than cesspools. They were rivers that just were draining chemical waste into the Great Lakes. And we overreacted to it in the media, but as a result, we got the Clean Water Act, and we got water in the United States that probably rivals cleanliness of water 150 years ago or better. So there's something to be said for that, and this is why the price of oil, you're paying for that. I mean, if you want clean water and oceans that don't have bobs of goo floating around on them.
Just to throw this in there. Texas is leading the world in fracking. This is not a surprise. Oklahoma has a lot of fracking going on too. Oklahoma is having lots and lots of earthquakes. It's kind of died down in the media because they're having them so much that they don't really even talk about it. But if you go to the seismic activity maps, and there's lots of places that have that information, you'll see that Oklahoma is having lots and lots of earthquakes, which is, they're not big earthquakes, they're little earthquakes, but they're still damaging infrastructure. They're damaging water pipes, they're damaging roadways and bridges and dams, and basically everything that is attached to the ground is getting damaged in small ways, but it's cumulative. Texas is not getting the same kind of earthquake activity. And it's very easy, by the way, to determine the cause of these earthquakes. If you look at the epicenter on Google Earth and you zoom in, you're going to find a fracking field. So this is not even a question anymore. At the beginning, a lot of people were denying that fracking caused earthquakes. It isn't fracking that causes the earthquake. Otherwise, Texas would have a lot of earthquakes. It is the disposal of the acid wash in the ground instead of reusing it. It's at the beginning of a fracking process, it's a lot less expensive to just dump the water in the same hole that you use the water in. It's not really water anymore. There's just slight dilution of water in a bunch of different types of acid that eat up the shale and allow us to pull hydrocarbons out of it. It allows us to get the oil out of the rock. In Texas, we don't allow people to dispose of the chemicals in the ground. They've got to reuse it. So they pump all that stuff out, and over the long term, it's caused companies doing business in Texas to be more profitable because after the initial stage, reusing those chemicals is a lot less expensive than mixing new ones. Oklahoma is still under the impression that it's less expensive if you just dump the water in the ground and you get these earthquakes. So it's the same kind of mentality that sometimes does require a larger governmental organization to step in and say, you're doing damage to more than just your state. And that's what happened in the Great Lakes area with the Clean Water Act. It's likely to happen in the future at some point with fracking. Well, they'll look at good practices and say, this is the way you should do it. That's just the way when a technology starts maturing, governments start saying, okay, let's limit the damage that was acceptable damage because it was boosting the economy so much. But now that it's matured, you're not adding a lot more jobs. You're not adding a lot more new economic benefit, so we're going to limit the damage that you're doing in the process. Sometimes the government goes way overboard. Sometimes it doesn't go far enough. A lot of that judgment has to do with where you sit politically rather than whether you really think there's real damage. So throw all of that stuff together with ANWR or offshore drilling, and what you realize is that the companies, oil companies, no longer just contend with the price of the oil. There's also an ecological value that's associated with their name. If you doubt that, look at the numbers of millions that are spent by the large petrochemical companies in saying how good they are to the environment. Would a for-profit company spend hundreds of millions of dollars telling you something that it didn't think it needed to tell you? No. So that is a risk that underlies, it doesn't matter if you're a proponent for the oil companies or you're totally anti-oil. The whole concept here is we've got to find a societal balance. What do we spend money on? And in the case where we're buying oil, it's not just the oil. It's also after the BP disaster, BP filling stations were used less. It's not like their gasoline tasted any different than the other stations that were just around
tasted
it.
Tasted any different?
Well, I say the same thing about electricity. I mean, we've opened up the market to electricity, but it all tastes the same to me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. It's 10:30. It's probably, or 10:31. It's probably time for us to do some commercials.
Yes, it is. We'll do that. If you would like to contact us over the break or after, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I'm Jake. This is
Jeff.
Jeff. We're both McClures, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side with more.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And Jeff is practicing a basso profundo voice today, courtesy of some virus that is dwelling in my vocal cords. So we're in a cooperative operation.
Today's program is brought to you by the virus in Jeff's throat.
Yes, the viri. There's a bunch of them.
Viri.
Yes, I think there's a viri in there. Anyway.
It would be a lot of viri or a virus.
Yes, but it can't be viruses.
No.
Okay, so let's talk about what happened in the markets during the week.
Good idea.
I heard the first alarming headlines I saw, market melt-up. A melt-up is the opposite of a meltdown. A melt-up is when stocks rise, not because of any underlying news or information, but simply stocks start rising because they're rising.
Right.
And we actually saw that this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed 25,000 for the first time in recorded history. It may have been an unrecorded history point where it didn't cross it or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Recorded history, yes. Caveman's Dow Jones Industrial Average may have been at 25,000,
right.
And they promptly forgot about it.
That's
wrote it in sandstone instead of marble.
That's right. So we don't know. In the end of civilization, the Dow could have crossed 25,000 earlier, but we don't have any record
right.
of it.
No recorded history of it.
They took the record and broke it. And so it closed out at, the Dow closed at 25,295, which is like 295.87, almost 300 points above the 25,000 mark. It's worth noting when it crosses 25,000.
We've got another three records that were broken. Big records. Big records.
The S&P 500 high?
No.
NASDAQ crossed 7,000?
It's not market. Well, it's market. It's just trade. External trade. Three records were broken.
Okay, tell me.
We did the most exporting we have ever done in the United States in a given quarter or a given month. Okay. We did the most importing we have ever done in a given month.
Mm-hmm.
We had the highest trade deficit that we've ever had in a given month.
Yes. Actually, we didn't, but
we did.
The Commerce Department thinks we did.
Yeah, well, this is the record that was broken, is that
We
exported more than we ever have. So this is a good way of looking at political spin. Depending on where you stand politically, you could say, we are under the biggest push on exports we've ever been in the history of our country. We're exporting more than we ever have. That would be a current administration, doesn't matter if it's Obama, Trump, any way you look at it, they would say, look, this is a record that's gotten broken. Someone that is trying to get elected would say, biggest trade deficit ever. We are being bamboozled by the rest of the world. They're taking our stuff and not paying for it.
All right.
Both of those are
Actually,
true.
It's the other way around.
Or at least semi-true.
They're selling us more stuff than we're buying from them.
Right. And that's one of the things, is that politics is not a good lens to look at economics. And it's a horrible lens to look at economics.
If we have any listeners who are part of the millions of people who follow the Trump tweets, his comments about unemployment and the rise in the stock market earlier this week, towards the end of the week, were
kind of opposite tweets that he made during the election.
They're just wrong. This is not the biggest rise in a presidential. I mean,
no.
During President Obama's first term in office, the stock market was 41%. I think it was first year, first term. Anyway, so if he's going to say this is the biggest rise, well, actually, President Obama had a bigger rise.
Not that Obama or Trump have anything to do with this.
They don't have anything to do with it. And I'm not trying to say that the rise is because of Obama or the rise is because of Trump. I'm simply saying, unfortunately, he tends to exaggerate a little bit in his tweets.
And, hyperbolic.
Yes. And suffice to say that they were wrong. Just bear that in mind and go on about your business. The interesting thing to me is for 52 weeks, the Dow Jones at 12 months from this point last year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 27%, and the S&P 500 is up about 20%. The NASDAQ is up about 30% from this time last year. That's impressive. It is still supported. The values we see in the market are still supported by underlying fundamental economics, and that's the important thing to recognize.
In some cases, there are, just as you were, I totally agree with you.
In the market as a whole.
In the market as a whole. There are a lot of areas that I look at and I go, whoa, that's really, really not good. Basically, you get anywhere into what people would consider new technology.
The fangs.
The fangs. If you're talking about Tesla, if you're talking about Facebook or Google or Apple or anything along those realms, if you look at their price-to-earnings ratio, you should realize, hopefully, that the prices that are being asked for those companies are fantastical, fangtastical. They're high.
Well,
you have 140 as a price-to-earnings ratio. That's a little bit high.
But it's one of those things, frankly, that you don't know. And the reason I say you don't know is, for instance, at some point, Amazon is expected to settle down and stop trying to grab market share but ignoring profits. And if it ever does and focuses on profitability rather than market share, the quantity of earnings that company would generate would be phenomenal. In other words, you look at the earnings that company is capable of generating were they not so busy spending money on other things.
Right. Their price-to-earnings ratio is 312.
Right. And the point,
just for those of you that don't know what that means, it means it would take today's net earnings after all expenses 312 years to pay back the current price of the stock. There's some good news there in that Amazon could stop trying to establish market share and
eventually they're going to run out of market share to grab.
And then they will just be taking earnings. by the time they run out of market share to grab, the Justice Department may be breathing down their necks mm-hmm. with antitrust stuff, the way they did with Microsoft, which I think if you just wait a little bit, they almost did it with Walmart. If you just wait a little bit, another competitor with a new technology is going to come along and eat their lunch too. Just, who is it going to be? Who knows? We didn't think Amazon was going to do it to Walmart, and that's what's happening.
Well, the plus is what we're not seeing a lot of, and matter of fact, other than Bitcoin, I'm not seeing it much of anywhere, is companies that come out with no business plan, no profit projection, no profits, and not much of anything else, and they come out and do an IPO, and the price immediately doubles and quadruples and quintruples because they're an IPO. Now, right now that's going on in the Bitcoin area, and it can go on for a long time before it blows up. I happen to agree with everybody who has analyzed this and looked at history.
It's a mania.
That is going to collapse one of these days, and it's going to be a spectacular collapse.
This isn't to say, you know, when we're going about our business and we see a 25% drop, I said this a couple of weeks ago, I don't think this is the end of Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a mania behind it, and it's going to go for a ways. The end of it is going to be spectacular, not a 25% drop. It's going to be really big.
Well, I thought when you talked about breaking records a few minutes ago, I thought you were going to talk about the fact that the S&P 500 has now gone 385 trading days without falling 5% or more from its 52-week.
That is one of the things that record gets broken every new trading day.
Right. But the point is that this is the longest. It is currently, without a correction of 5%, and that's not much of a correction, this is the longest the S&P 500 had gone upward without dropping 5% on some day. And one thing I can tell you with a high degree of confidence, there are no certainties about the future, but I can tell you with a high degree of confidence that one of these days it's going to happen. And
Market tends to go down sometimes.
I think a lot of investors have forgotten that that's even possible. On the other hand...
That's not a good sign for the market long term.
On the other hand, the individual investors through the end of 2017 are still pulling money out of equities.
Right.
And putting it in bonds.
I do a weekly update to some data about net. It's kind of like net import-export, only it's net money into, out of equity positions, into, out of bond positions. We have a very positive flow rate of individual investors pulling money out of stocks and putting them into bonds over the last 5 years. During this entire bull market that's been going on, people have been taking money out of stocks and putting them into bonds. When we can very easily, you know, we're talk back and forth about, is the equity market mature? Where are we in the cycle? Is it ready for a drop? And we're saying, no, it's pretty, as a market as a whole, it's pretty evenly priced. It's pretty equal to earnings. Oh, we're looking good. When you ask us about bonds, bonds are overpriced almost across the board. There are some places where they're not, but the vast majority of bonds are overpriced. Interest rates are likely to go up, and when they do, bond prices are going to come down. These are some easily verifiable things, likely to go up interest rate. Did you read anything about what the Federal Reserve's talking about?
Four?
Yeah, half of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee is talking about raising interest rates four times in this year. The other half is talking about two times. So we're going to have some interest rate hikes this year, unless some major catastrophe happens, and even with the major catastrophe, because we've just had this amazing boon, short-term boon to the economy of taxes. We've just had a tax cut that is just phenomenally going to add a lot of money into the system. That's going to cause a lot of growth. It's also going to cause interest rates to need to be raised so that we don't get inflation out of it.
Which reminds me, there's one negative indicator out there regarding the stock market, and it's consistently negative. Not completely negative, just it's a caution. But I think it is not to be relied on at all at this point, and that is the yield curve.
I still rely on it.
Well, the yield curve, as it gets more flat, in other words, as the difference between short and long-term interest rates becomes less, historically has been a signal that the stock market, the economic expansion and the market rise that goes with it are reaching maturity and will eventually reverse. And once the yield curve inverts, where shorter-term interest rates are higher than longer-term interest rates, that's a signal we're in for a bear market. Now, the problem with that signal is historically, never before historically has the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank been in the business of buying bonds on the open market or selling bonds on the open market. So that has to be a major, major, major distortion that's going on in the bond market, because the central banks in Europe and in the United States are the 800-pound gorillas participating in the market. And that by itself is driving interest rates.
It should give a different weighting to when we look at the yield curve. But I want to remind you of Alan Greenspan back in 2006, 2007, as the yield curve was not only flattening, it was inverting. It stayed inverted from 2005 through 2007. And Alan Greenspan said, that's weird. Usually the yield curve, when it goes inverted, it's a very short thing and it leads almost immediately to a recession or to a bear market of significant potential.
Right.
We're hanging out here, and he called it the conundrum. Well, it hung out there for 2 years before we had the recession that we call the Great Recession.
But it was also, at the same time it inverted, the index, the conference board index of leading indicators started down, and they started down 18 months before the market did, which is or the economy did, and
the conundrum.
So once you get a series of indicators all saying there's something wrong here, we're being irrationally exuberant. Yeah, that's true. But in this case, every other indicator, including the index of leading economic indicators itself, is saying the United States economy is not only doing well, it seems to be accelerating.
Right, and the yield curve was a lot flatter for almost the entire decade of the 90s. And the 90s was a very good decade. So a flat yield curve, which we're experiencing now, is not the danger sign we're looking for.
It's not really flat, it's just not as well sloped as it might be.
Right. It's kind of flat but not inverted. And it's not as sloped. It's the longer term rates are still higher than shorter term rates. They're just getting closer together.
And you know, once the European Central Bank stops buying bonds, which they haven't, see, buying bonds causes longer term interest rates to be lower, and we're in a global economy. And as a result, you would think that what the European bank, as it buys bonds in Europe, wouldn't have any effect on U.S. Treasuries. Well, yes, it does, because the customers are the same.
Right.
And so that keeps long-term interest rates lower than they would otherwise be. Federal Reserve is, meanwhile, in the business of raising short-term rates.
Mm-hmm.
And
we have an external pressure keeping the long-term rates lower.
So once the European Central Bank gets out of the business of buying bonds, the yield curve, I think, will actually tell us something about what's really going on in the economy, as opposed to what is artificially going on because of a central bank's action.
I'm going to give a prediction, and this is just personal opinion. I would give myself about a 70% probability of being right here. I think in about 6 months, the Central Bank of Europe will stop purchasing bonds. They've debated it the last several times.
Well, they've suggested that they're going to agree with you.
And when we look around, all of the nations of the European Union are in growth. Their GDP is going up. So I expect that they'll be stopping their quantitative easing of buying back bonds. And we're going to see that kind of across the board that interest rates are going to start going up on the longer term stuff too, which means that if you're looking at buying a house, you should probably do it now if you're going to get a mortgage. If you're not going to get a mortgage, you should wait. Think about that one for a minute.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Because as interest rates go up, people buy houses based on the monthly payment. And if interest rates are going up, the monthly payment goes up, which means you can afford less house, which puts a downward pressure on real estate prices when once the long-term rates start rising again. So keep that in mind. If you're about to sell a house or buy a house with cash, selling right now or anytime in the next few months, even into the next year, probably a great seller's market. A lot of people want to buy. Mortgages are there. Interest rates are still relatively low. Once interest rates start up, you're going to have to ask less money for your house if you want it to move. So some little bit of heads up. If we're talking about yield curves and we're talking about what sounds like really esoteric stuff, it has a direct impact on your day-to-day existing. If you understand what it is, you can benefit from it.
This stock market that we're in has been running up very smoothly. To summarize this, it's being driven up by professional institutional investors. The public, meaning people who invest in 401ks and who buy individual stocks and individual mutual funds, has not, by and large, participated. And we've mentioned the fact that the cash flows right now are negative in the equity market for individual investors. Once we see individual investors start to pile on, and we see the market start to take off as a result of that, then I think we can have some concern, some reasons to be concerned and some reasons to be worried. But one of the key elements that at least is influencing my opinion about this is that the economic cycles as we knew them in the last half of the 20th century, at least as I knew them in the last half of the 20th century, and even in the first part of the 21st century, the cycles that we could pretty well depend on, the business cycle, which boils down to the fact that businesses buy stuff based on last year's sales data. They buy new stuff for this year,
right?
And they build up inventories and they sell, and that goes on, and they gradually accelerate that over time until the consumers run out of money or desire to spend. When all of a sudden, one year, businesses will have too much stuff and they will chop their orders suddenly. Meanwhile, the manufacturers have been ordering stuff to make stuff with.
Because they think this is going to keep going on.
And so you get this load of materials and finished products in the supply train. And when the supply train stops,
the people that put money into that lose their money or have to wait a long time to get their money back.
And companies start laying people off, which of course further exacerbates the lack of buying. And that kind of cycles back on itself for a while. And then at some point, companies have hunkered down as far as they're going to hunker down. And the consumer looks around and said, my credit card bill is now reasonable. I think I'm going to buy some more stuff. And the consumer comes back to buy and finds out there's not enough stuff in inventory, and then we start the cycle again as the retailers demand more stuff and the manufacturers begin to produce more things and people start to get hired, which provides more money into the system for buying things. This is called the business cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been thoroughly studied and is well understood, and we have it all figured out except for one major element.
Yeah, the first people to pick up this major element was Dell, and then Walmart through McLane. That was on-demand purchasing, where you, and Amazon does that, where you buy something and they didn't have it sitting in a warehouse. Or if they did, it only gets ordered again once you purchased it. It isn't immediate.
So this cycle is fairly well understood, but it has changed dramatically because of transportation and technological changes.
Can you talk about the corn hog cycle? This will help people, I think.
Well, yeah, but it, okay, corn hog cycle. What happens is and this has been going on a really long time. It was thoroughly studied in the early 20th century. A lot of papers came out on it, and it became sometimes it's called the hog corn cycle, and sometimes it's simply called the pork cycle or the hog cycle. But it is a situation where somebody looks at the price of pigs and notices that the price of pigs are up. And so they go to buy some little baby pigs so they can raise them into hogs and sell them.
At this new higher price.
At this new higher price. Well, it takes a while. It takes a year or two to build up a nice herd of hogs. Actually, it's a 4 to 6 year cycle that it runs in. Because everybody doesn't do it exactly at the same moment. But people start buying hogs and they begin to feed them off of their, traditionally at least, this is the way this would work, off of their locally produced food. And sometimes with a small case, that was just garbage that they threw out. And in bigger cases, it's what they grew on their own property. Well, the price of hogs continues to go up. They continue to raise more hogs. They may sell a few, but they're increasing their hog herd size. You like that?
The young herd is called a drift or a drove or a litter.
What, a young herd?
Older pigs are called, when they're grouped together, is called a sounder.
I think a hog or team or passel. Okay, passel or hassle?
Passel.
Okay, there's a passel of pigs out there.
And here's where it gets really weird. If there's a whole bunch of boars, they're called a singular, which doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, I think if you were in the middle of a bunch of boars, you'd find it to be a singularity.
I agree.
So the issue is that as the herds build up and the profitability goes, people keep building the size of their herd of hogs. And they said, well, I made a lot of profit on it last year, so I'll just continue to build on this. So the price of hogs and pork continues up until it doesn't. Well, okay, and here's the issue. At some point, it levels off and starts back down again because people say pork's too expensive.
It's time to sell the pork.
And the hog seller, long before this, has run out of capability of feeding his own hogs, so he's been buying corn.
Corn's going up in price because so many people are buying corn to feed.
So the corn farmer is planting more and more and more corn and less and less and less of maize or whatever else that particular farmer was planting. But he has to plant a year in advance to harvest the corn, so he's got a lead time too. So these two work together and the prices rise together. And then one year, the hog market would drop precipitously because people would bring a bunch of hogs to market and the price would be down, and that caused a panic sale of hogs, which oversaturates the market.
Which causes the market to drop even more.
Which is this panic sale, and of course then the corn farmers discover that year they have way the heck too much corn, so the price of corn starts to drop. This can go on for a couple of years before it starts back up again.
That cycle lasted for centuries, many centuries, throughout early human history, and was broken by the railroad.
New form of transportation means geographically something was inserted in there, and beef came in on the hoof on high-speed railroads.
High-speed being 30 miles an hour.
But they still were able to get the cattle to the market, and people could buy beef for the price of pork, and it upset that we're going to go into more detail about what that has to do with our economy next hour.
Yeah. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we're about to have to break for our hard break for commercials. If you'd like to contact us off the air locally, phone number is
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that toll-free 1-800-914-7526. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.